I now ask Mr. Shrimpton to give us his presentation entitled, Is the Bible Reliable Today? Thomas Paine was born in Norwich, England, in the mid-1700s. He moved to the United States towards the end of that century and went to France in the time when the French Revolution was progressing. And then he went back to the United States in 1802, and he died in 1808. Now, why talk about Thomas Paine? Because Thomas Paine was one of the leading lights in the beginning of the period which we now look back on and call the Age of Enlightenment. And Thomas Paine wrote extensively about the need for new forms of government in Western society. One of his most famous essays, entitled The Rights of Man, argued strongly for the abolition of the monarchy and the removal of the monarchy and replacement of that form of government by a representative form of government, a democracy as we now think of it today. So why talk about Thomas Paine removing kings and setting up an American-style form of government when the title that we have to deal with is the Bible reliable today? Well, the reason is actually quite simple. And if you read this one particular essay entitled The Rights of Man, you find that one of his strongest arguments for removing the king from a form of government within Western nations comes from Moses. Thomas Paine used the argument in Moses that there should not be a king in Israel, to say that there should not be a king in any of the Western nations. It was the wrong form of government. We needed a different form of government, and Moses proved it. And the interesting thing is that the Age of Enlightenment was the beginning of serious criticism of the Bible text. And when Thomas Paine returned to the United States in 1802, he was instantly vilified as an atheist. Because even though he'd used Moses in one of his arguments, and if you read his other essays, you find that he quotes scripture a great deal. He uses personal examples throughout the Bible of what people did and the way they lived their lives as reasons for the way he was forming, saying that people should live their lives from that point in history onward. Thomas Paine relied on the Bible for many of his arguments. He's an indication of the respect people had for the Bible, even at a time when people were starting to look at it critically. It wasn't long after that that people began to notice little things in Genesis, like the land of the Philistines. And then they kept reading and said, well, how could it be referred to as the land of the Philistines in Abraham's time when the Philistines didn't appear to exist for at least another 500 years? More than that, probably close to 1,000 years before the Philistines actually appeared on coastal Israel. And that was noticed. There's a town called Dan mentioned in the time when Abraham lived. Now, was the city of Dan named after Dan, who was the great-grandson of Abraham and was named before Dan was born? What's going on here? And then they realized that the Chaldeans were a people in the time of the Babylonian conquest. The Chaldea then was an area, a territory, around the time when we were read from Jeremiah today. That was when Chaldea was a territory. So how could Ur be in the Chaldees when the Chaldees didn't exist when Abraham lived? And there were all kinds of little questions like this that people picked up, and they began to pick the text of the Bible apart carefully and judiciously. And there came to be a whole school of biblical criticism which determined that indeed the text of the Bible must have been written from dim and distant memories, or maybe even made up. A lot of people would argue that the text of the Bible was largely made up, a set of myths and fairy tales which were made up to satisfy a religious elite sometime after 400 BC. Now, there are people who will argue that maybe Deuteronomy was written as late as 800 BC, and they base that on the fact that in the time of Josiah, there was a book of the law found in the temple. And the record in the Kings says that, look what I found. And the new, and this law was read, and it was a surprise to people. And that's the way it's presented in the historical books of the Bible. But that gave rise to the thought that maybe that's when Deuteronomy was written. And people began to look for words and phrases, like those little phrases that I just mentioned to you, that seemed to be anachronisms, that seemed to be words which were used out of their time-related context. And another one that people picked up and use as an example of a late writing for the most of the books in the Old Testament is at the time when Solomon built the temple. And it's rather interesting because we have in the book of Kings, we have this record of how much money was collected. And for a large building project like that, you have to collect money, you have to get your resources together before you start. People do it today and they did it then. And there's a list of the things that Solomon did. He got all his materials together. He made his trading pacts. He was a businessman and he raised his money. Now, interestingly, when the coins were listed that the money was raised in, one of them was called a darik. There were so many thousand dariks raised to build the temple. Now, that's fascinating, say the critics, because the darik was named after Darius. And Darius, the temple, had to be constructed earlier than 900 BC. Whosever time frame you use, 900 BC is about the latest date for Solomon and the temple. The date for Darius is somewhat closer to 500 BC. So you have at least 400 and probably 450 years difference between the time when Solomon raised Dariks to build the temple and the Darik was actually minted. So when was the text written, say the critics? And we'll come back to that point in a while. But here's an example of the thinking that has gone on. And the ideas that the Bible has been picked up from a lot of dim and distantly remembered myths, made up in large parts, woven together from three or four or maybe more different sources over the years. And what we see now is a compilation of people's thoughts and ideas, myths and legends, which really were put together as a book somewhere after 400 BC, at least so far as the Old Testament is concerned. When you get to the New Testament, the critics pick the text apart with equal fun. And they look at things like the Sermon on the Mount. And they say, well, that's great. And if you go there as a pilgrim, as a lot of people do nowadays, and they walk up and they take a bus, actually, up to a parking lot where there's a monastery. And you can look down over the Sea of Galilee, and it's really a peaceful place. And you can imagine being with Jesus there as you look down on Galilee with the sight of the sea below you. The Sermon on the Mount, they say, was delivered from that place. Quite interestingly, though, when Luke records the same event, Luke says that Jesus went up into a mountain, and he went apart to pray. He left his disciples, he went separated from them, went to the top of the mountain to pray. And then Jesus came back down, says Luke, to the disciples, and they went out onto the plain. And it was on that plain that the Sermon on the Mount was delivered. So say the critics, how can you have a Sermon on a Mount which was also delivered on the Sermon on the Plain? Now, a little later on, we're going to look in some detail at the feeding of the 5,000. We looked at this last Sunday morning and developed some very interesting personal messages from that text. But the critics look at that text and they say, well, look, Jesus, all four Gospels will record this. All four Gospels are absolutely certain about this, that Jesus took them out into a desert place. And all four Gospels, no, three of them, I'm sorry, are equally certain that there was a lot of grass there. So how can you go to a desert where there is a lot of grass? And then when you look at the description of the people, the group that was there, it varies from place to place. And so the critics say, well, look, You've obviously got something which couldn't happen. How can you could take five little bits of bread and turn it into food for 6,000 or 7,000 people? That's not possible. So what you've got is a myth wrapped up in a bunch of ideas that people have glued around it, and these ideas differ from speaker to speaker. We will come back to that. So there we are as a cook's tour through some of the things that you can read if you pick up books on the subject of textual criticism in this day and age. And you get some idea of the way the minds are working of theologians in our society. And you get some idea then of why people don't respect the Bible nowadays. You get some idea of why people will say that much of the Bible is completely irrelevant to today's society and to the way we think, the way we act, our economy and our social values in this day and age. So what I want to do is go back. Go back with you to the time of Joseph. And we'll look at Joseph for a few moments. Then we're going to skip forward to the time that we read, the time of Jeremiah and Ezekiel and those prophets and the destruction of Jerusalem under the Babylonians. And then we'll step forward to the feeding of the 5,000. And each time we'll ask this same question. Does the story that we read make sense within the historical context that it purports to be? Could it be that they were real, live, historical ventures? What's the internal evidence from the document that we have before us? Does it really appear, when you analyze it, to be historical? And can we then say that Joseph, who was a good, 4,000 years earlier, 3,500 years or so earlier than us, can stand with us today in the example of his life, of values and things which we can build into our lives today? And does the fact that Joseph, if we can verify him as a historical factor, does that mean that his life is relevant to our life when we stand today? Well, the story of Joseph is quite simple. He appears, I guess nowadays we would call him as a spoiled child. He's somewhat the favorite son of his father. He was given things that the other brothers didn't have. The other brothers took it out on him, decided to get rid of him, sold him to a bunch of traders, and he found himself in Egypt. He rose to prominence in Egypt, and then when the family needed to come to Egypt to buy supplies because of a famine, they were close to starvation, Joseph was able to care for them with the bounty that he had preserved in Egypt. And then the bones of Jacob and Joseph were taken back into Palestine, into Israel, into the land of Israel, when the nation returned sometime later after they had been enslaved by the Egyptians. Well, that's the cook's tour through the whole story. The next thing we need to think about a little bit is when this story could have happened. And most Bibles have usher's dates in the top of their page. And if you follow those through, you'll see that Abraham was certainly somewhere around 2000 BC. And it's hard to figure exactly when Abraham lived, but somewhere in that period. And Joseph, a little bit later than that. And exactly when you date Abraham and exactly when you date Joseph, somewhere between 2000 and 1500 BC, they have to fit, and a probable date being about 1900 to about 1700 BC for the actual fit of their time. Now, why raise this? Because quite interestingly, when you look at things like the Mari archives and look at some of the most common names which were given to boys in that period, you find Jacob, you find Isaac, you find Ishmael, you find Joseph. So even at a very simple level like that, the names of these patriarchs were common names in Canaan at about the time the story purports to be. So even at an elementary level, that's the case. Now thereafter, the prominence of those names declined. But during this period from about 2000 BC to up to about 1500 BC, the names of the patriarchs were common to that period. Now, if you read through your Old Testament, you don't find those names so often. They've been picked up again more recently, and in present-day Jewish society, many of those names are very, very common. They've been resurrected, as it were. But they were present and given to a lot of boys during the time of the patriarchs, during the probable time of the patriarchs. They declined in prominence, and they've come back with a modern era in Israel's history. Now, that's a very minor point and almost a nothing point, but it's interesting that the prevalence of the names fits the probable time frame for these people. Inflation has been with society for almost as long as we can imagine. And if you sort of go back through all the stone tablets and things like that, you find that slaves around little before 2000 BC were sold for around 10 shekels. Somewhere around 1600 BC, the price of a slave had inflated. It was now around 20 shekels. When you get to the time of Moses, the price of a slave had gone up to around 30 shekels. And you can draw a curve, an inflationary curve, on the price of a slave. What has this got to do with the story? Because the brothers sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels. And around 1600 BC, that was the going rate for a slave. So you have to ask yourself now, how did the Old Testament writer arrive at 20 shekels? If he wrote this around 400 BC, it seems unlikely. They got the right names. They got the right pricing structure. What else did they get right? The Egyptians had textbooks, just the way we have textbooks. And there's one particular textbook which was written around the Ramesside period, which was transcribed in the Ramesside period, in Ramses the Great and all those people. And this is a textbook of how to interpret dreams. The interesting thing about this particular textbook is that it's in columns. So if this happens in the dream, then that. If that happens in the dream, you go to column so and so, and you work your way through. It's almost like a modern computer program, the way it's laid out, quite sequentially and quite logically, how to interpret a dream. The other fascinating thing is that just as with many of Shakespeare, we still use the phraseology that Shakespeare wrote in the 1600s. Why? Because we consider it such important and classical English. It's important to keep the language of Shakespeare the way Shakespeare wrote it. And that's what the Egyptians did with this text, which dates to somewhere around 1200 BC. They kept the ancient language intact so that the language of that text on interpreting dreams fits more closely to the first half, to the second half, I'm sorry, of the second millennium, which is the same time frame that we're talking about. So we know that there was these set of formulas in Egypt at the time when Joseph was there, at the time when the Bible says Joseph was there. Let's say it that way. We know that the Egyptians had that textbook for a way of interpreting dreams. Their textbook didn't fit these particular dreams. And that was the remarkable thing as far as Joseph was concerned. So you see, little things like the names, the inflationary, the monetary value system, things like the textbooks which were available for the Egyptian mystics at that time, they're all flowing back into this period of somewhere between 2000 and 1500 BC. And all of them sort of fit generally in that framework. Joseph interpreted Pharaoh's dream, and Pharaoh's dream was, as you recall, the animals, the cows, fat ones and thin ones, and the thin ones devoured the fat ones, ears of corn, and the thin ones devoured the fat ones. And this was interpreted as years of plenty followed by years of famine. And so the prescription, of course, which Joseph gave was that you should take aside some of the bounty which you have from these good years and keep it for because the bad period is coming. The description of what to do now is interesting. Because what is said there is, firstly, that you should appoint someone to oversee the program. The next statement in the prescription is that you should appoint supervisors. Why? Because Egypt in the period that we're talking about in the Old Kingdom was a central authority with a series of provinces going north to south along the Nile. So each province then would have had a supervisor to care for, to make sure that stores were set aside from the good years for the bad years and used in the bad years. The little description like that fits the governmental system which was in place in Egypt from that period. I have to keep putting my glasses on because I don't want to miss a point. Now, there's an old phrase which was, you may remember that in the 1800s, the Rosetta Stone was discovered, taken from the French. The British then now have it in the British Museum. And this combination of British experts and particularly a certain Frenchman called Champollion enable people to interpret the two forms of Egyptian writing which were on that Rosetta Stone. And we have a copy of the Rosetta Stone in the showcase at the back. It's not on display at the moment. But with the Greek, which was on the top then, the Demotic, which was the more cursive Egyptian script, could be finally interpreted when one realized that that was the same as the Greek, and the hieroglyphic, which was the other one. And so from that point on, people started to be able to read the Egyptian script. So, having done that now, all kinds of manuscripts became evident. And there was one manuscript which was quite harsh on foreigners. And there was a phrase in this one particular manuscript which stated categorically that there should be no foreigner rise to a position of prominence in Egypt. And so the critics then said, well, Joseph couldn't possibly be true if Egypt would never allow anyone to rise to such a position, because Joseph rose, we are told, to be effectually the second most important person in the land of Egypt. How could that be if Egypt wouldn't allow foreigners to grow that far within their society? Well, as time went on, it became apparent that that certainly applied to more than one period in Egyptian history. There were periods when they were very much against foreign invaders, periods when they restricted the access of foreigners most severely. But in the years following 2000 BC, the time when we're looking at for Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, there were several times when foreigners were recorded as not merely going in and out of Egypt as trading people, but also being in the presence of Pharaoh. And that's important, because the Bible says that Abraham was in the presence of the Pharaoh in Egypt. It could certainly happen at a time when we estimate Abraham was alive. It could also happen at a time when Joseph, and the Bible indicates that Joseph went down into Egypt. Now, there's a manuscript from 1730 BC, which lists the staff in a particular estate in central Egypt. And out of 77 different types of employees, 48 of them were foreign. And several of these foreigners had quite important positions within this estate. So you see, as you work through and you pull together more and more bits and pieces here, it's quite obvious that at the time when the Bible indicates that Joseph was there, it was entirely possible for Joseph not merely to have a job when he got into Egypt, but possibly also to have an important job when he got into Egypt. And the answers are there in Egyptian texts, and you can find these texts studies like the books that come out of the British Museum. There's an interesting little phrase of which refers to Joseph's boss. Potiphar, it says, was an Egyptian. Now, isn't that strange? If you go to Egypt and you meet a prominent individual, why is it necessary to call him an Egyptian? Because there were people in prominent positions in the land at that time, as we have just seen, who were not Egyptian. So even in a subtle little point like that within the text, it emphasizes the fact that it was possible for Joseph to rise through the ranks, as we say, to get to a position of prominence. Joseph, we're told, died at 110. So what? Psalm says that we have 70 years. And we quite often refer to that. I'm now 73. So I'm beyond my allotted time, according to the sequence in the Psalms. But if you read Egyptian literature, and particularly the Egyptian literature from around this here interval, 1500 BC and onward, you find that 110 was considered the ideal age for an individual who lived in Egypt. So Joseph, when he died at 110 in Egypt, was fulfilling what the Egyptians themselves considered to be an ideal lifetime. It's a little thing, but it fits the story here into an Egyptian framework. And more than that, we fit into an Egyptian framework which belongs around 1500 BC and earlier. In the 41st chapter of Genesis, we meet a couple of words that readers usually choke over. Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah, and he gave him to wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, or prince of On, some translations make it. A lot of scholars have tried to work out what those names might be. It's quite apparent that the second half of Joseph's name is very obviously Egyptian. As time has moved on, scholars have come to realize that this is actually ancient Egyptian, which is being transliterated. And what it is, and we find this again from this text which I indicated to you from 1730 BC, which lists all the servants and the various people that were in that estate, 77 of them. The foreigners were all given two names. One of the names was an Egyptianized form of their actual name. And the other was the name that the Egyptians gave them. So the most recent analysis that I can find for these two words, which are Joseph's name, are that here you have a Semitic term which has been changed into Egyptian form. Who is called, and the second name gives him his Egyptian title. And that Egyptian title carries the suffix of the Ankh, and that was the symbol of life in Egypt. So this man was evidently considered to be an important individual worthy of life, and Pharaoh gave him a name which indicated that. Now, the wife's name is also fascinating, and it too transliterates very well from this early period in Egyptian history. And this wife's name then isn't really a name. What it really means is she belongs to you. So Pharaoh had given her to Joseph. And that act of Pharaoh giving this daughter of someone else to Joseph for a wife is enshrined in the name which we have here. Not really a name, but an indication that from here on in, she belonged to Joseph and not to her Egyptian father. I find it really interesting that when you start looking for details in these stories, when you start looking beyond the thought that maybe if the land of Philistines is mentioned in Egypt, how could that be? Because the Philistines didn't exist then. Maybe what we should start to argue is that the name Kaphtorim, which is probably what it was called before this time, didn't mean anything to people when they came back from Babylon in times like that. And so therefore it was necessary to give that a new geographical title. Continental British Columbia was known as New Caledonia before 1850. This is our 150th anniversary of our actually being proclaimed as British Columbia. Prior to this, the land that we're standing on was the Crown Colony of Vancouver Island. But now we're no longer a Crown Colony of Vancouver Island. We're part of British Columbia. Names of places change. And if you want to keep current and have people understand what you're talking about, you have to change the name of the place as time goes on so that people will recognize where it is you're talking about. New York, of course, was New Amsterdam at one time. The Dutch founded it. And yet, if you talk about New Amsterdam nowadays, unless people come from New York, they probably don't know what you're talking about. And that's the point. With little phrases like the land of the Philistines occurring in Genesis before the Philistines existed. So now I want to step ahead some many hundreds of years, and we'll come to the time of the Babylonians. Come to the time when Jeremiah was writing. Come to the time when this Marduk released Jehoiakim from prison and left him. He was actually still under house arrest in Babylon, but gave him a favorable position and gave him rations. And we'll come to that in more detail in a moment. But before we talk about that, let's just review what's been going on in the Middle East around this time. The Battle of Carchemish had been some 30 years earlier than the point that we're talking about there with Jehoiachin. And in the Battle of Carchemish, the Egyptians were thoroughly defeated. The Babylonians then took over most of the area of the Middle East. And the Babylonians then became the dominant force throughout the land of Israel, throughout Syria, through what we think of as Lebanon, all the way then from Babylonia out to the coast and right down to the northern borders of Egypt. They really didn't penetrate very far into Egypt, despite the massive military victory over the Egyptian army at Carchemish. But if you remember from your maps, Carchemish is sort of, if the Euphrates comes up like this, then Carchemish is sort of over here. So the Egyptians had actually moved all the way through the land of Israel and Syria, and they were then sort of pushing up against Babylonian borders at that point in time. And the Babylonians defeated them soundly and pushed them all the way back. At that point, the nation of the land, the Judeans, came directly under the influence, and they became part of the Babylonian Empire. And because they had been part of the Egyptian consortium, a number of people were taken from Judea into Babylon as slaves on that occasion. Now, the interesting thing is that the Babylonians kept what we might today call daytimers. They had scribes, and they kept a daily record of what was going on. And then periodically, all the scribes would get together with the head scribe, bring all their daytimers, and they'd look through them, and then they'd say, well, you know, this is important, and that's not so important, and make them forget about that. And then they would come up with an interval of maybe around a month in which the highlights of that month were recorded on clay tablets, and those tablets were then read to the king and to his senior advisors. And the whole idea here was that the Babylonian records should satisfy the requirements of the king and his senior advisors. And they should be brought down then to a concise form and stored in the library from that point on. And many of these tablets now are, many of them are in the British Museum, a number of others are in the Berlin Museum. And those tablets are many of them translated, and that translation is ongoing. So we know for certain that what's stated in Kings and in Ezekiel and in Jeremiah about the Babylonian conquest is cross-referenced. The events, the time distances between them are cross-referenced. What happened, the slaves that were taken, the tribute that was taken, the taxes that were levied from the land of Israel, all of those things are in the Babylonian Chronicles. So one can say without any doubt at all that the bare bones of the text that we have in the closing books of Kings and Chronicles, in Jeremiah, much of Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, the first 24 chapters of Ezekiel anyway, we know that all of that is cross-referenced within the Babylonian Chronicles. So there can be no doubt in anybody's mind. You have to accuse both parties, who are completely independent of one another, of making things up independently and in the same form if you want to argue otherwise. Now, the other thing which comes out of this is that the Hebrew people were, of course, they had their own heroes. They had their own people that they valued, their own people that they looked up to. And what happened is that the scribes would, when they wrote a text, would tie it up with a leather strap of some kind, and then take the two ends of the leather strap and hold them together, take a piece of clay and press it over the ends of the leather strap, so you have a little blob of clay there holding the text tight, and then the scribe would write on that little blob of clay what it was about and who he was and what the text was. So that then you send the text to somebody and they read the seal and, oh yeah, they know what it is, they know who sent it, and they know what they should do with it. Now, in Jeremiah, we have reference to one Baruch, as it is in my translation, or Berechiah, as is the more precise Hebrew translation, the son of Neriah. And we know that he wrote much of Jeremiah's prophecy. Now, the fascinating thing is that more than one seal has been found with exactly those words on it. The seal of Berechiah, the son of Neriah. So we know that that man existed. We know that the seal fits, and the strata, the archaeological strata, which belongs to the time period when he was supposed to exist. We know what he was doing, because this seal was the type of size and form of seal that was used to seal a manuscript. Everything fits together. There are a couple of others which are well known from seals. Gemariah, the son of Shaphan, is another scribe. We find him in the 36th chapter of Jeremiah. Several of his seals have also been found. And then there's another man. another sort of little short interval of history. The Babylonians and the Egyptians clashed again after the Battle of Carchemish. Both armies destroyed themselves so severely that neither mounted any military campaigns for some time. It was during that period that Jehoiakim decided that he could be free of the Babylonians. Rebelled is the word which we have in our Bibles. And he refused to send his taxes to Babylon. That, of course, got the Babylonians mad. And the Babylonians came back a couple of years later after they had had time to rebuild their armed forces. And they took Jehoiachin, his son, who was now reigning because the father had died, off to captivity. And that was the little reference which we read at the end of Jeremiah to introduce this topic. Then they put Gedaliah, to oversee the land of Judea on their behalf. Let me get the words right. There is a seal, a larger seal, several of them found, which talk about Gedaliah, the high steward. So you see, the people from this time. Now, the steward's seals were often larger because they were used for different types of things. They may be used to seal parcels. The taxes, when they were wrapped up, were all counted and put in a box of some kind, wrapped up, sealed. Gedaliah, the high steward's seal, would go on a piece of freight like that to go back to Babylon. So the Babylonians could open it and say, okay, this is from Judea. Gedaliah has sent it. It happens that we haven't found those seals in Babylon, but we found them in Judea. The people come alive. The places come alive. We now know that the river Kibar, where Ezekiel was said to be await the vision of the Lord, was an irrigation channel in Babylon in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. We also know that just as it says in Jeremiah that Arwel-Marduk, the king of Babylon, evil Merodach, as it is translated in my version of the Bible, but Arwel-Marduk would be a little more precise form of his name, that he did indeed release Jehoiachin in after 12 months, in the 12th month, in the 5th and 20th day of the month, of when he, just after he had ascended to the throne in Babylon, that he released a number, and this is recorded in the Babylonian archives, that he released a number of foreign kings. It was the beginnings of the sort of period of democracy that was coming into the Middle East, which culminated with the Persians. And Jehoiachin and his rations, the exact things that he was given, the daily portion of this, that, and the other, they're all listed in the Babylonian Chronicles, and that tablet is now in the British Museum. So you cross-reference the facts and the event. There's one little point of difference. You notice that this Babylonian king did three things. He looked favorably on him. He pointed him up above all the others. He gave him his rations. We know he gave him his rations. We know that he looked favorably on a number of kings. It's not so certain from the Babylonian Chronicles that Jehoiachin was that much above the other kings, because there were several of them released. But he certainly was in a favorable position. So the people come alive. So when you can then look at a life story like that of Ezekiel and realize that his whole life had come apart. He had lost his job in the temple. He had been transported. He was a captive in a foreign land. He had lost his position in society. He had lost his income. He had lost everything, his friends. He even lost his wife when he was in captivity. His world had been shaken. And yet we can look at a person in those states, as we can look at Ezekiel, and realize that his faith did propel him forward. His faith did sustain him under very difficult times. Well, now to the New Testament. And now to the feeding of the 5,000. And as we said, you start out looking at what the critics say about stories like this. And, well, where did it happen? We're not quite sure. What was going on here? Well, how can you have a lot of grass in a desert place? And so quite obviously, the whole story is just sort of made up. It doesn't really exist. But then you haven't really asked the serious question. How can you have a lot of grass in a desert place? And the answer is in Nabataean agriculture. Now, the Nabataeans were a group of people who, just prior to the Roman period, lived throughout southern Jordan and through much of the Sinai Peninsula and up into the southern part of Israel. And they had a very fascinating form of farming. It just so happens that these soils throughout this period, in a lot of desert areas, the soils have much the same characteristic. They're very silty. They blow. But when rain falls on them, these soils instantly coalesce. And so you quite quickly have almost a sheet of waterproof material on the surface. And so as the rain falls, the next few drops of rain flow over this sheet of coagulated silt, which is on the top, on the surface, and water collects in the bottom. And this is the reason that wadis overflow so quickly. This is the basis for the man who built his house on the sand and the man who built his house on a rock. Because you build your house in a place which is sandy and the rains come, they wash over quickly. You don't even know it's coming. It can be miles away and the flash flood comes right down the valley and can take away your structures. What the Nabataeans did then was farm in a valley as it comes down. And they put little dams coming down the valley, so that as the water flowed over the top, it would collect up against this first dam, fill that one up, flow over. And then in a year when there was plenty of rainfall, they may get 5 or 6 little fields formed like that, flooded and ready to plow. So as the ground dried up, they would plant their seeds and they get a good crop because they've retained the water. What's this got to do with all the grass which was in the desert? Well, the same thing applies if you've got a basin. The water collects on the side hills, flows down into the bottom of the basin, and holds there, and then gradually flows out through wherever the exit hole is. Basins are contain that water for a little while. The ground floods, the grass grows that much more richly. So it is possible to have a lot of grass in a desert place. When? Now, for that, we have to go to John. Luke is the only one that doesn't actually mention the grass in this place. But John mentions something else. John tells us that the Jews' Passover was at hand. And then Jesus went up into the mountain to pray. And after he had prayed in the mountain, he went apart with his disciples into a desert place. And John says there was much grass there. So when did this event happen? It happened in the late spring. It happened at the end of the rainy season. It happened in a time when if you go from the Sea of Galilee, and that's where Jesus was to start the story, up into the northern end of Galilee, climb the hill, and look out over that plain when you're getting into the April, May time. And it does look dry. It does look dry. It looks green for a few weeks in the middle of December and thereabouts. It does look like a desert, but in these basins, it can be wet and moist and much grass, as John says, and green grass, still green grass can be there, as Mark puts it. So you see, little things about the story come together when you compare. They're not conflicting ideas, we simply need to think about them a little bit. Now, critics have also said, where did all the people come from? 5,000? More than that? Where did all the people come from? The answer again is in John. The Jews' Passover was at hand. And the answer is also partly in Mark. For Mark says to his disciples, we must get away, to put it in modern terms. The crowds were bothering them. Jesus said, we must rest. We've got to get away in modern terms. And so he and his disciples escaped from the throngs that were pressing around them, probably in Capernaum, and went across, diagonally across the lake to an area near Bethsaida. And it's Luke who tells us that it was near Bethsaida. And climb the mountain to get away from everybody. Where did all the people come from? Well, the Romans had an estimate made of the number of people that attended Passover on at least one occasion. Josephus records this for us. They could find out from the temple records how many sacrifices had been performed at this particular festival. So you go to the temple records, you find how many sacrifices, then you make an estimate of the number of people that would have been involved in each family group who brought their sacrifices. Multiply that together, and Josephus tells us that the number came out to over 2.5 million people in Jerusalem for Passover on that one year. Many of them would have come on the northern route on the west shore of Galilee, down along Jordan, and then up the Jerusalem to Jericho road. That's where all the people came from. They were on their way to Passover. As John tells us, the Jews' Passover was at hand. It was not too far ahead in time, and they were on their way. They were stopping in places like Capernaum for some supplies and a little rest, and then on they went. And while they were there, they met Jesus. And they stopped to listen to him. And they crowded around him to the point where he just had to get away, and he went away to that desert place. But there were still 5,000 and more who found him there and followed him. When you look at John's record, it's a little difficult to know exactly what was going on. But it would probably be better to translate the phrases in John. "Let the people sit down," John said to his disciples. And then the men sat down. And we find from Matthew that there were 5,000 men that they all grouped together in companies of 50s. And the women and children were in addition to that. What does that tell you? It tells you that the men and the women were separate. It tells you that the men could be sat in little groups and the women sat in another group along with their children. What does that tell us? It tells us that the Jews treated Jesus the way they treated their rabbis. That this was just like going to the synagogue. If they had gone to the synagogue in Capernaum, the men would have sat down this side and the women would have sat down that side with their children. That's what happened in religious meetings in that period in Jewish history. They respected Jesus as a teacher. And it shows even in subtle little things like this. So that was why they were willing to sit down in groups when the apostles told them. That was why they behaved themselves there. It wasn't just an afternoon entertainment. It was a serious religious experience for them. That's what they expected from Jesus. And the text, the subtle things in the text tell us that. Now, there were 12 baskets of food picked up. Why 12? What about the baskets? Well, it happens that the word which is translated basket there is just a little basket, a little woven basket, what we would think of as a basket, the sort of basket which nowadays takes the place of the ubiquitous backpack. It was what you put your personal things in, your supplies for the day, and the little bits and pieces that you took with you when you traveled. It was just a woven wickerwork thing with a handle on it. And they all carried one. And that's why there were 12 baskets, because each of the apostles had one that he could collect things into. There's another miracle, the miracle of the 4,000, and the critics say, well, look, somebody's got things wrong. You can't, this is the same story, but somebody's mixed it up this time, got the numbers wrong, among other things. The interesting thing is that there they picked up a different number of baskets in our English. But the fascinating thing is when you look at the Greek for that word basket, it's not a small personal woven basket. It's the sort of thing which you make from rope when you wind it around what you've got, loop it and knot it, and you've got a quickly made basket. It's the same word which was used when Paul was lowered down over the wall in a basket. A rope sling was what they sent him down with. Now when Jesus later on in Matthew compares these two miracles. "Don't you remember," said Jesus, "when we fed the 5,000 and when we fed the 4,000? Jesus uses the small basket word, the personal basket word related to the 5,000, the other word related to the miracle of the 4,000. Jesus keeps them clearly separated. The text keeps them clearly separated because there was much grass in all three of the four texts. But they sat down on the ground for the miracle of the 4,000. One more little thing, and I'll wind up and shut up. It's getting late. But I would like to say this. Luke tells us that Jesus went across the lake with his disciples to find this desert place, and it was near Bethsaida. John says that when Jesus looked up and saw the multitudes, he turned and said to Philip, "We have to find them something to eat," in so many words. Philip's response to that was, we can't manage that. We haven't got enough money. Why ask Philip? Why address Philip? Now, the other thing is that Andrew was also there as part of this little knot that was discussing this problem. And it was Andrew who said to Jesus, "Look, we do have this little bit of food here." And that was what Jesus used, and that was what worked the miracle. Why was Andrew involved? Because when you look at the first chapter of John, and you find out where all the apostles came from, Philip and Andrew, and also Peter, came from Bethsaida. So the logical thing to do when you're in that part of the world and you're talking over a problem relative to that part of the world is to ask local knowledge. All of the Gospels sort of fit together. From Luke, we know where it was. From a completely separate part of John, we know that those were the two people to talk to. The record comes together. And so what we've got here is a miracle, yes. But it's clothed with all kinds of little facts which fit together. And the four different records for this miracle glue together and explain the other parts which the various gospel writers don't mention. So what is it? When you talk about things a little differently, describe them a little differently, when you use different phrases, when you leave different things out, what does it mean? It means that you have four separate eyewitnesses. And this miracle, in its four versions, has all the earmarks of four independent, observant, and accurate eyewitnesses. So when we think of Joseph, when we think of him being sold into slavery, when we think of him making the most of a bad situation, and we think of his faith buoying him up, we can think that, yes, indeed, it's almost certain that Joseph lived. It's almost certain that Joseph lived in that period. And there's no reason to doubt it. So we can consider him to be an example for us in this day. When we think of Ezekiel and Jeremiah and Baruch the scribe, we know that they lived. We know that what they did and what the Bible says they did more than likely happened. There's no real reason to doubt it. And we can look at those people as examples of faith and fortitude and fit them into our lives. And when we look at what Jesus did when he fed those 5,000, we can say, yes, it was a miracle. And yes, I don't know how it happened. I can't explain it in scientific terms. But we can believe it. And we can accept it because the records hold together so carefully. And we can consider then that what Jesus was doing was caring for people on two levels. He taught them, he cared for them on a spiritual level, and he fed them. He cared for them on a physical level.